Hi, Jack.
Hello, Bob. How are you?
I'm pretty good. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well this morning.
I should say I'm trying to get in the habit of saying, for the benefit of our podcast listeners, who exactly they're listening to. I'm Bob Wright. You are Jack Balkin.
I am indeed.
Professor of law at Yale. You also started the widely read law blog Balkanization, which includes a number of bloggers, not just yourself.
Right.
You know, I was wondering, the fact that you named the blog after yourself, does that signify high self-esteem or what exactly?
No, I had to figure out what to call it, and I asked my wife. At the time, I was the only one blogging. It was just me.
When did you start it?
I started almost 5 years ago, January of 2003, so it'll be
early.
The 50th anniversary soon.
For a not strictly political blog, for a kind of niche blog.
Right. I was an early adopter, and over time I realized I couldn't do this by myself. So what happened was I started asking lots of friends I have in the legal academy and lawyers to join in, and now it's a group blog. I mean, I regard it as a group blog, and it is sort of balkanized in the sense that there are lots of different people with lots of different views. So it turns out great.
Wow, and that was without planning at all.
Some of the greatest things in the world are created without planning.
Many, some would say. Many things happen organically.
This is my view. And yours too, I believe.
What's that?
It is yours too, I believe.
It is my view, yes.
Yeah, all right.
We share this view. So we agree, so we can, I guess, end this conversation.
No, we'll have to find something else to disagree about.
Disagree.
That was the point of this conversation.
I definitely have. I'm gonna later argue with you about the very merit or lack thereof of your whole vocational endeavor of kind of thinking and talking about jurisprudence. But I wanted to start off on civil liberties.
Yes.
Because this morning I was thinking about this, and I went to the New York Times website, and in their little search thing, just put in wiretapping, and kind of disturbingly, I guess, got 5 New York Times articles over the last 2 days.
Yes, things are hotting up, as they say, with the FISA fix bill that the Democrats are planning to replace the Protect America Act, passed in August.
And the New York Times piece yesterday made it sound like they're kind of chickening out. There was this paragraph about that saying, although willing to oppose the White House on the Iraq war, they, meaning the Democrats, remain nervous that they will be called soft on terrorism if they insist on strict curbs on gathering intelligence. Mm-hmm. Now, can you, first of all, for the benefit of people who haven't been following this assiduously, tell us what you think kind of the main issue? I mean, as I recall, the whole FISA thing, we found out some, I don't know, year, two, whatever ago, that the government had been eavesdropping on calls involving American citizens. Is that right? And that the Bush administration thought they had the legal authority to do so, or what? Can you
FISA ignorant. Requires, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, requires that when you engage in electronic eavesdropping, which involves American persons, that is, persons who are citizens of the United States or resident aliens in the United States, you have to get a warrant. Even though the purpose of the intelligence gathering is for foreign intelligence surveillance. So there's a statutory scheme, and what the Bush administration did was to route around that scheme and simply begin a program of both international and domestic surveillance, some of which involved United States persons. But they didn't go through the FISA court, and they didn't seek FISA warrants. And this was leaked to the New York Times back in December of 2005, and the administration, after a while, simply admitted it had a program. It might have had more programs, but that it regarded the program as being legal. Many people, myself included, think that, in fact, that was incorrect. The program was illegal, and it also violated the separation of powers. In August, the Bush administration pushed for, at the beginning of the August recess, a reform of FISA, a FISA fix bill, which it called the Protect America Act. And what it did was to say that there is a technical problem with FISA that prevents us from getting information about foreign terrorists outside the United States, and we need to amend FISA quickly or else the terrorists will strike.
Now, were they talking about conversations involving foreigners alone, or was there concern conversations involving an American and a foreigner?
The purported justification for the fix was that the telecommunications companies had structured the cables and the nodes through the network so that you could listen in on foreign-to-foreign conversations in the United States, because the Internet doesn't respect borders and telecommunications doesn't respect borders anymore.
And the Bush administration feared that that would preclude their listening to foreigner-to-foreigner communication?
Exactly. That's what they said, and therefore they said, we need to fix FISA now. What had stimulated it was a decision by a secret FISA court suggesting that that practice was no longer legal. But what the administration did was to use that excuse, which is, I think, a perfectly valid excuse for amending FISA, to push through a much broader bill, the Protect America Act, which essentially said that foreign intelligence surveillance directed at persons reasonably believed to be overseas is not electronic surveillance at all. And by defining electronic surveillance as not electronic surveillance, they got around FISA. They also, by the way,
so they're broadening it in a way that could ultimately apply to American citizens?
Certainly, because if it's not electronic surveillance, but it's reasonably believed to be directed at a foreign person, a person outside the United States, then if you call anyone overseas, even for reasons having nothing whatsoever to do with national security, the government would, in theory, be able to listen to your conversation because it was directing its surveillance at somebody who was outside the United States. And if you're a person who has many friends abroad or has contacts abroad, like a journalist, then, in fact, it would be a relatively easy matter to listen in to a lot of your conversations.
Without a warrant.
Without a warrant. And the other the secret sauce in the mix was because you take it outside of FISA, you also take it outside of FISA exclusivity provision, which says that FISA is the exclusive means by which you can authorize foreign intelligence surveillance. And so the Protect America Act did a lot of things. It blew an enormous hole in the civil liberties protections for Americans.
Okay, so just to spell out the nightmare scenario, if someone like me had, say, been critical of the Bush administration in print or on the air, I mean, not that that would ever happen, but...
No, I know you would never do that.
I would never do that. But suppose somebody in the administration got a bee in their bonnet to try to get some dirt on me. And of course, this kind of thing happened in the Nixon administration, I guess. They would not need a warrant to listen in to any conversation I had with a foreigner.
True. Now, if it were to be proved that the foreign intelligence surveillance was directed at you, that you were a target, that would be not permitted even under Protect America.
Well,
the problem is there was no oversight to determine whether or not the foreign intelligence surveillance nominally aimed at a foreigner was aimed, in fact, at you. The Bush administration resisted repeatedly any attempts to place oversight provisions in the new Protect America Act, because they felt it would disclose information about surveillance that could be of benefit to our enemies.
So is that that where we stand now? It's the new Protect America Act that's up in Congress, and some people fear the Democrats aren't being sufficiently vigilant?
Well, the Protect America Act expired after 6 months. So it's going to expire, I believe, in March.
Okay.
The Democrats are trying now to come up with a fix that will supersede Protect America, and they... there are versions both in the House and the Senate. I believe one of the versions, although may not both, is called the Restore Act. Why they need these acronyms, I don't know, but that's apparently what it's called. Now, the New York Times has given a rather pessimistic view of the bill, and there are some things in the bill that are worrisome, but there are also some things in the bill that are not as bad at all as the Protect America Act.
Mm-hmm.
And a few of them are actually things that needed to be done in the first place. I haven't read the whole bill. I've read a summary of the bill, and so you must take what I say with a grain of salt, in addition to taking my legal analysis with a grain of salt.
Everything you say I take is gospel.
Well, that's good. That would be like treating me as the salt of the earth, which is slightly different than a grain of salt. But in any case, one thing that the bill will do is simply produce the rule that the Democrats wanted in August, which is simply that if a surveillance is reasonably directed at persons outside the United States, it does not matter for purposes of FISA that it travels or the packets travel through the United States. You just simply fix that as a technical matter. Everyone supported that. I supported it. The Republicans supported it. It is not a controversial measure. The more interesting issues in the Restore Act have to do with so-called blanket or basket warrants that allow the government to institute a program which, instead of targeting specific individuals for surveillance, targets places, operations, organizations, facilities for surveillance.
For all of these, foreign, or
well, the idea would be that you would have to go in front of a court and establish that the program was likely to reach only foreign-to-foreign communications or only foreign intelligence communications. And indeed, as I understand the summary of the Restore Act, it also requires that it not be any foreign intelligence communication, but it has to be related to terrorism or a threat to national security. And that's important because the Bush administration didn't want any limitations on subject matter. So in this sense, it's actually a little better than the Protect America Act. The other thing that's really quite crucial is this. However you design the warrant system, so you're not going to have individualized warrants for these foreign intelligence communications, but rather warrants that are blanket warrants, you have to have oversight. You have to have some method of proving to a court that these things are not probably going to get any Americans. And second of all, you have to have oversight and auditing provisions so that even if before the fact you think it won't have this fact, you have to report, well, who did we in fact pick up and how many of them were Americans and what are we going to do about it? These oversight and auditing provisions have been severely resisted by the Bush administration. They don't want anything to do with them. Now,
is there a struggle right now to strip them out at this moment?
The Democrats, I believe, as I read the summary of the bill that's before me, and I really want to get my hands on the actual bill, are including a bunch of auditing and oversight provisions in the new act to bundle with the blanket warrants. This is crucial because whether or not you think the blanket warrants are a good idea or not, or whether they violate anybody's civil liberties, certainly it's even worse if you don't have oversight provisions. Go ahead.
Well, is your sense? Are you fairly fine with the bill as you think it, as you take it to stand at this moment in the wrestling match?
No, I have to see the actual details of the bill because I have to understand how the audit system works and the oversight system works. And before I can see that, I really can't tell you. I am troubled by basket warrants, but they may be necessary given the way in which telecommunications occurs now.
What's the scariest thing that could happen under a basket warrant system?
Well, you mean with or without oversight? Without oversight, then essentially it's what you were worried about before. You just do it all through basket warrants. And
you're able to attack all of your domestic political enemies should you choose to, basically.
I just want to point out that attacking domestic political enemies is not the worst or the most important of these scenarios. It's rather that ordinary Americans' private lives will be spied on, inadvertently or advertently, I guess, by a relatively zealous bureaucracy. And that's, in fact, what we're dealing with. We're dealing with both a bureaucracy, which, as you know, has its own problems, and a zealous bureaucracy, one that is devoted to protecting Americans and therefore will do what it thinks whatever it takes to secure Americans. And in the process of that, you can overreach. And also mistakenly viewing some people as threats to security that aren't threats to security. Mm-hmm. These things are inevitable in any sustained foreign intelligence program. The idea is to put safeguards in place to prevent their excesses from becoming too serious. That's why the oversight provisions are crucial. There's one other provision I need to mention to you. This is the issue of whether or not telecommunications companies, not all of them did, but those that cooperated with the Bush administration, in the period between 2001 and the present, when it was, in my judgment, illegal to engage in these surveillance techniques, are retroactively given legal immunity for what they did.
Mm.
The Bush administration is determined to ensure retroactive immunity, just as it was determined to ensure retroactive immunity for interrogators in the Military Commissions Act of 2006, because
right.
There was a significant possibility that the interrogators violated the War Crimes Act, as well as the a prohibition against torture and cruel and inhuman and degrading treatment, both under federal and international law.
I guess one problem with that kind of immunity in general is that if some future administration decides to push the envelope or even go beyond it on either of those fronts, torture, wiretapping, whatever, and the precedent is, hey, if they catch you, they wind up forgiving you. That does seem like a dangerous precedent to set.
It does suggest that the president can give some assurances that if somebody violates the law, that they won't be held liable for it, and that will make people more likely to want to cooperate with violations of law.
Yeah.
Now, the thing that is so ironic about the administration's push for retroactive immunity is that it suggests, together with the Protect America Act and the new Restore Bill, that, in fact, the administration didn't have to do it this way, that in the wake of 9/11, in the early days of September and October of 2001, it could have gotten even more than the Protect America Act, and certainly more than the Restore Act, by simply asking Congress for permission and then placing the FISA fix on a secure legal footing and placing the NSA's programs on a secure legal footing, and then no telecommunications company would have to be worried at all about whether it participated. What's so interesting is they didn't go to Congress, and I think the reason they didn't go to Congress was because of an almost pathological view that it was the president should maximize his power wherever possible and not cooperate with Congress where it was unnecessary, with the hope that Congress would simply cave later on. Well, perhaps it's all turned out that way, if the Democrats cave and if they provide retroactive immunity. Then, in fact, the Bush administration strategy of the president on steroids will, in fact, have paid off. But I think that's a bad way to play politics.
Yeah, well, they probably could have gotten a lot more than that right after 9/11. And one thing that scares me about this whole issue in general is that the amount of power that people will willingly cede to the government in this regard varies tremendously depending on how frightened the public is feeling at the moment. I mean, fortunately for us, where this legislation's being hashed out in a context where we don't feel a super imminent threat. Similarly, I remember when the Supreme Court, the Jose Padilla case was the case where the Bush administration was in effect ignoring habeas corpus, right? Because Padilla is the American citizen, and they were basically saying...
Yes, also with Congress, too.
Okay, and they were saying, we can take an American citizen, not let him have a lawyer, not explain to anybody why we're holding him. I mean, that was just a threat kind of to all of us. It finally, as I recall, I'm probably wrong, but it finally wound up getting the Supreme Court right. And I remember thinking, I hope we don't have a big terrorist attack before this decision is reached, because my own view is that that would have swayed the Supreme Court.
Yes, I agree with you. I want to say another irony, which is implied by your comments, I just want to draw it out, is that even given the fact that we are now some 5 or 6 years away from 9/11, and you would think that fears had to calm down, President Bush, through playing the terror card, was able to get the Military Commissions Act, which effectively suspends habeas corpus, and the Protect America Act, which blows an enormous hole through FISA, and the latter he was able to get from a majority Democrat Congress. And that suggests that even when fears have died down a bit, politicians who want to engage in a little bit of demagoguery, and I think that's exactly what the administration has done, will be able to force their political opponents to cede valuable civil liberties because their opponents suspect that they'll be punished for it at the polls. That is to say, the Bush administration still believes that it has the upper hand on these questions. It is a very sad commentary, both on the state of American politics and also on the lack of willpower by the Democrats in Congress. I'm very hopeful that the Restore America Act will not be as much of a debacle as the Protect America Act was.
Let me pause and say I feel a little guilty whenever two people kind of seem to agree this much on blogging and TV, because first of all, people find agreement boring. Secondly, it's actually not as illuminating of the issues as disagreement is. But I will say, in this area, it's actually hard to line up a lot of really contentious debate. I'm sure there's people we could find, but the basic problem is, as you know, in the blogosphere especially, if we're getting bloggers to be on Blogging Heads TV, as we often do, in the blogosphere especially, a fair number of the people you think of as conservatives, as on the right, are actually conservatives of the libertarian stripe. So in the law blogging world, you think of like Eugene Volokh, you know, the Volokh conspiracy. And basically, those kinds of conservatives, and that probably is the most prominent conservative legal blog, come to think of it. I don't know. But those kinds of conservatives largely agree with you on this stuff, right?
Some do. Some don't. I think some...
Who would disagree? Who would be a good person to get to argue with you about this?
Oren would be. In fact, Oren and Marty have talked about it before. In fact, on Blogging Heads TV.
Right, that's right.
Go ahead.
Is he not a little libertarian in other contexts?
Oren, I don't regard as Oren's not a conservative at all in some respects. He's a moderate. But he studies this area.
Okay.
And his view is that that many of these reforms are necessary. And I don't know what his exact views on Protect America were,
okay.
But I think he's be a little bit less worried about the civil liberties implications than either you or I would be, although, in fact, I think he would probably think that a lot of the previous activities were illegal. But there are other people outside of the blogging world, in the national security world.
Well, wouldn't Jack Goldsmith, who has his book that got a lot of play and has since been cast as kind of anti-Bush because of some themes in the book, he would defend a lot of this stuff, wouldn't he, or not?
I think so. I mean, I think Jack's view, and I haven't spoken to him about it, but I think his view would be that whether or not the 2001 to 2006 version of the program was legal or not, that very significant reforms to FISA are necessary, mm-hmm. and that he would not regard civil liberties as a major concern in reforming FISA. He would say, well, civil liberties is important, but what's more important is giving the president a relatively free hand to engage in foreign intelligence surveillance, because that's
okay.
the important thing.
Okay, well, we'll line up an actual argument on this then, possibly including, I don't know if you'd be game, but even the notorious, is it John Woo?
John Yoo.
John Yoo, I'm sorry. The Bush administration's the architect of a certain amount of this stuff,
John is a very forceful advocate for his views, and he's very personable, and so he would be a wonderful person to bring on.
Okay. We were going to talk about.
I thought there was an obvious. Actually, there were two things we could talk about now.
Okay.
I'll give you the choice. First, we can put this current debate in the larger context of how American governance is changing. The second thing is we can talk about your frustration with lawyers and the legal arguments they make. So, for example, you and I have just had this conversation. I've laid out my views, but you also pointed out we could probably find somebody who would reach exactly the opposite views on these same issues, and they would be a lawyer, and they would make convincing legal arguments as well. This is frustrates you to no end. So which one do you want to talk about? Or do you want to talk about both in different
ways? If you have a quick spiel on the governance thing, why don't you do that, and then we'll move on to my skepticism about the whole endeavor of legal argumentation.
Yeah, I think it's time for you to doubt my whole reason for being, Bob. I think that would be appropriate at this point.
I might be good for you. It's going to hurt in the short run, but it might redirect your career in a productive way.
Well, that which does not kill thee only
makes you stronger.
Right. Yep. So the larger question is that we've been moving for the past, 10 or 12 years, from a national security state into a national surveillance state. And I use the term national surveillance state without trying to get everyone frightened or afraid. I want you to understand that what's happening is that the collection of information has become a central mode of governance in modern Western societies, and particularly the United States. So that what we're seeing with the FISA debate is a debate over how much we will rely on government officials to basically collect as much information as they can, to use it for purposes of national security. But it's not just limited to FISA. As you know, in many cities, video cameras are going up everywhere. In addition to state-owned video cameras, also private ones are being put together in a large
right.
network. Enormous amount of consumer data is collected by businesses who then analyze it and data mine it and then sell it to other businesses and the government for purposes of expanding markets, for putting goods and services in people's hands, for advertising, and also for surveillance. This is a big, big feature of how we live our lives today and how we govern ourselves today. And governments will use this information more and more to make not only the big decisions about national security, but all sorts of decisions about parking tickets and whether you can find deadbeat dads and how do you provide government services, ordinary government services. These are the features of a national informational state, of which a part is a national surveillance state. The big issue. Yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say, I mean, a certain amount of this, as you suggested, is just going to happen organically. There, you know, we live in a transparent age. I think The Transparent Society is maybe the name of the book by David Brin.
Yes, that's right.
About this. And you know, he pointed, as other people have, to a lot of the upside. And you know, it's tougher to be a criminal if every square foot of sidewalk is under surveillance, not necessarily by the government. It could just be apartment, you know, dwellers who have a video camera trained through their window, you know. And,
that's right.
And a lot of this is just going to happen, the transparency, and it may be, I don't know, maybe that the things you focus on are observing the government's use of it. In other words, making the transparency transparent in its use or something. I mean, I don't know, but go ahead.
That is, in fact, right. That's one strategy people suggested, that if privacy is increasingly limited by technology, and that's really part of the story of the national surveillance state, which is that not only the bad guys have access to the technology, but the good guys did, and the good guys wanted access to it because the bad guys had access to it, and the technology drives the creation of the surveillance state. Also, markets to drive the creation of a surveillance state because, in fact, businesses want to know more about their customers in order to provide them with goods and services and to offer them things. And then, of course, once you have the tools for that purpose, you can then, of course, turn those tools for other purposes as well. The technology does not, in fact, limit itself to one use. It can be used for many things. The key issue in the national surveillance state is finding ways of limiting the arbitrary use of data collected. And that means, in the FISA context, it's oversight and auditing. In the context of private surveillance, it's limiting how information can be collected, how information can be used, and also how it can be sold or transferred to others. Those are the key issues in the national surveillance state. The basic problem is, how do you preserve a democratic culture in a world in which surveillance becomes more and more a part of how government does its job?
Mm-hmm.
And the central thing, and also that much of the surveillance is done in private hands. So you have to put in these structural features and technological features to solve it, whereas in an earlier age we would have relied primarily on the creation of legally enforceable rights enforceable by judiciary. Well, that's still part of the story. But we shouldn't expect that most of the protection for our privacy will come purely from judges deciding cases. It will also come from legislation, administrative decision-making, internal auditing by bureaucracies, and also regulations of business practices, and also technological design. All of these things will be necessary in order to preserve some degree of privacy in this coming surveillance state.
And, you know, it occurs to me that this may to some extent be a generational thing. I mean, you and I are let's just say we're past our undergraduate years.
We're mature.
And I notice that, you know, younger people, I think, are less self-conscious about revelations about themselves. I mean this you know, the kind of MySpace Facebook culture, there's more of a willingness, it seems to me. If I spent some time in these places, maybe I'd have some right to actually speak about this as if I knew what I was talking about. But it seems to me there's more of a willingness to put a big chunk of their lives on display without being very discerning about who is watching. I know there is discernment. There is discernment that you're either, you know, you can say, well, only my friends can see this, but their friends tends to be such a large number of people that basically, for practical purposes, you know, the cat is out of the bag, or whatever the metaphor is, and you know, I mean, anything they're putting out there, basically the whole world can know it if anybody in the world is interested, kind of. But do you sense? Well, you teach. I mean, do you sense a difference in sensibility in younger people in this regard?
I think younger people are schizophrenic in this regard. On the one hand, fame is extremely important to them. Being well known is
unlike us,
important.
Right?
In a different way. I mean, this would be another conversation
succeeding?
You could have about how the notion of fame changes from the 19th century into the 20th century, and how we're just part of an ongoing trend.
So we want to be famous in a semi-respectable way, and then they're willing to go Paris Hilton?
No, I would say that as the 20th century moves on, people born later and later view fame as a different kind of good than people born earlier, but we're a part of it too. I mean, after all, Warhol is older than either of us, and Warhol had
and
seen
debtor.
It coming. And in fact, what a lot of what Warhol's art is about how the notion of fame is being being transfigured in culture. And so we came of age in that period anyway. But the internet, if anything, just simply extends this general tendency even further. And so I forget the poll that suggested that many people would, the thing they'd like most to be would be a rock star, and then after that, a personal assistant to a rock star. Right, that was the second best one. Well, that's because of the benefits of fame, and the benefits of what fame can offer, both positive fame and negative fame. That I think is the interesting thing: is that people no longer simply want positive fame. They think that fame of any sort is a valuable, powerful tool in the kind of world we live in, where attention is the coin of the realm.
You know, this would be a kind of transition into something we were thinking about talking about anyway, which has to do with this book you edited called The State of Play.
The State of Play, right.
And kind
with
virtual.
Beth Novick.
What's that?
With my friend and colleague Beth Novick, who teaches at New York Law School. Go ahead.
And it's about virtual worlds. And, you know, so I guess that includes, like, The Sims and what? Is Second Life the name of one?
Second Life is actually one that many academics care a great deal about.
Do they participate?
World of Warcraft. Some do, yes.
Have you immersed yourself in these worlds much?
To a certain degree. I have to say that my co-editor, Beth, has done more. I have many students who spend a lot of time in these worlds and now have gone into teaching, and this is a central part of their research. I got interested in it because I was more interested in the general question of freedom of speech online. And it seemed to me that you can't think about freedom of speech online until you think about this particular platform for speaking.
Okay, now that's interesting. I mean, it's first of all an interesting proposition that these worlds where people are, you know, it's supposedly just a game, you adopt an identity, people can see the, I guess, animated version of you or whatever, and there are various rules as the, some of them are more kind of fantastic, where I guess you can, I don't know, transform yourself into another identity easily, and some are more realistic, but there are rules of the game, and you can buy things, and you can, and some of them have sex, and you can do various things. It's an interesting proposition that these have come to be so important in the consciousness of some people that legal scholars really kind of need to help us get clear on what the rules should be. Now that's first of all interesting. My reaction to the claim, though, would be, and I'm sure you've heard this from a lot of people, would be let a thousand flowers bloom. In other words, whoever designs the game sets up the rules about freedom of speech. If you don't like it, move to another game. I mean, after all, one reason that freedom of speech and things like that are, you know, constitutional issues are so important in the real world is it's just not that easy for me to move to Canada as a practical matter, right? And so you can't just let the market decide on what the most attractive constitutional system is. Whereas in these games, I would think, my question to you would be, why should you get involved?
Well, there are several different ways to be involved, reasons to be involved with it. The first is what's so fascinating about these virtual worlds is that in real space, or meat space, as they sometimes call it, we try.
That's M-E-A-T, right?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Or M-E-E-T, depending upon, you know, which way of the pun you want to offer.
Yeah.
But it is meat space, like meat. M-E-A-T. We think there's a distinction between expressive conduct and action which is not expressive, although it's actually a pragmatic distinction. When you press on it too hard, you see that the distinction is difficult to make in practice. Although we think there's a difference between protesting, for example, and shooting someone. We think that one is an expressive act and the other is not an expressive act, or if it has any expressive elements, you can limit it to the extent that it's non-expressive, right?
Mm-hmm.
In virtual worlds, everything is representation. Everything is an act of speech. And so the boundary between what we will call speech for purposes of the world and what we will not call will probably be quite different than it is in the real world or meat space.
Why is everything an act of speech? I mean, first of all, I would be inclined to say that anything you do that has an observer in the real world is arguably an act of communication. But let's assume we accept your distinction and don't take that extreme position. Why can't you make the same distinction in the simulated world and say...
I'll give you a very simple example. In the old user, the old text-based MUD games, suppose you were an avatar and I was an avatar and I said, kill Bob's avatar. Take a stick and kill Bob's avatar. I type it in. What have I just done? I've just written the words, kill Bob's avatar, so that the very commands that I use to do anything are themselves speech. And so, in other words, everything I do through speaking.
But that's less true. I mean, now you can do that by moving your mouse and clicking.
Right.
I mean, it so happens, yes, that writing was the medium back in a cruder phase in the evolution of these, but not now, right?
Right. But everything I do, in effect, is done through communication. That is what you are really doing when you are moving the mouse and all this and typing.
Well, yes, impulses are going to your computer and they're going to the internet, you mean?
Everything you're doing would be considered an act of communication from the standpoint of telecommunications law.
Yeah, but I think that's a byproduct of...
And not only that, I should say, that all the torts that you... or crimes that you might commit in a virtual world would all be communications torts or crimes that are involve communication.
Yeah, but I mean, that's because the things you're talking about, you know, sending electrons flying up to the internet in ways that influence things, that happens to be a medium that was invented for purposes of communication. That's true.
Yes, but I think that is the point, in fact.
What's that?
That is the point, in fact.
Well, yeah, it was, but it seems to me the much more relevant question is... I will not be able to, having just confronted this for the first time, I will not be able to articulate.
I'll give you another example. That might be helpful.
Okay? Yeah.
What are the kinds of things that you might do to another person in a virtual world that terrestrial law, real space law, might be interested in and might want to regulate? Some examples are
killing them.
Go ahead.
Stealing their money is an interesting case because apparently, although this is like pseudo-money that's earned within the game, it matters so much to people that they, in the real world, in meat space, sometimes pay real money, right, for other people's pseudo-money or pseudo-credits in one of these spaces, right?
Right. So here's an example. That's the real-world commodification of virtual worlds. Most virtual worlds have virtual commodification. That is, they have, dragoons or Linden dollars or something, which is, for the purposes of the game, considered to be currency. And it's like play money, monopoly money. And it's a representation of money. It's not real money. It's a mere representation. It's used within the rules of the game. But, as you pointed out, many people have begun to commodify it in the real world. There are currency exchanges. Mm-hmm. And you can buy characters and special powers and magical objects.
Right.
And people will pay money for them. In fact, one thing you could do is you could run a virtual casino inside your virtual world, and you could pay people with the Linden dollars or the Dragoons or the World of Warcraft dollars or whatever, and people could make money by gambling. Now, if it turns out that money is freely convertible into real-world dollars, then effectively you've done an end run around the gambling laws. That's exactly what people are worried about.
That's true. I mean, actually, as it happens, the online world poses a threat to gambling laws in a more straightforward way as
well. Yes, I understand. But another thing that you could do, in fact, and this was what one company actually did, a fly-by-night company basically located south of the border into Mexico and hired people at very low wages to play the games incessantly so that they could, called gold mining, basically create lots of a currency for the games, which they then would sell on the market to get real money.
Mm-hmm.
So, virtual sweatshops, what can I say?
Yeah, it's interesting. I guess, first of all, I would say that still, if there is a game in which it's easy to steal people's money and people don't like it, they will leave the game and find another game, and that's probably the easiest way to get the regulation straight in all of these realms. And maybe some people enjoy the risk, you know? They like a world where you can steal. And the beauty of this is they'll just be dealing with other people who share that particular inclination, right?
Let me give you a slightly more far-fetched example and see how you feel about it. And let's assume that it was possible in this world, in real space, for you to change your identity at will with very little cost. So one day you're Bob, right? Mm-hmm. And then if you don't like how things are going, you could just become John Jones. And if you don't like how things are going, you could become, you know, Susan Smith or whatever.
And eventually resort to Jack Balkan if things
well,
get...
Well, you wouldn't stay there very long.
Get that bad, you don't think? Okay.
Well, there you go. But in any case, would you stick it out as Bob Wright, or would you change to John Jones relatively easily?
I'd be willing to change.
What about your family and your friends and your job and your contacts in the community? And
would I want them to be able to change, you mean?
Those have to go. Those all
well,
have to be.
Well,
you have to discard them.
Me, it was, the trade-off wasn't worth it. In other words, if my desire to be able to change myself was not so strong that I was willing for other people to be able to change, then I would leave any game in which that was the deal. I mean, that's
I understand that, but
just leave the game if you don't like it.
You get the analogy, but the basic point is this. In the way you see it, nothing that happens in one of these worlds is an important human relationship, as important as a human relationship you might have with your friends and family in the real world.
That's not the way I'd put it, actually, no.
Because I don't know what your relations with your friends and family in the real world are. I don't know. But the idea is the reason why people might think it unfair to require them to leave a game when the rules become unfair is because, in fact, they have a lot of themselves, and I mean that in all senses of the word, invested in that space because it's actually a community.
Mm. No, and,
yeah, go ahead.
Well, in a way, okay, that's it. It's kind of interesting that over time you could become so invested in a space that the difficulty of leaving is comparable to the difficulty of me picking up and moving to Canada. That's kind of interesting. Although I'm still not sure why. It's like so if the regulators of the game, the owners of the game, try to change things so much that there's a rebellion, I mean, they'll pay the price. Although it's true there will be some kind of carnage, some psychological costs in the meantime. But, you know, there's a bigger issue this raises, which is interesting to me, which is this idea that, I don't do these games, so I don't know. But the idea that they could acquire that importance is fascinating to me. And they clearly do to some people.
Oh, yes. There are many people who spend as many hours in virtual space as they spend in real space.
Yeah.
Some people for whom their community is a community in virtual space.
Yeah. And you know...
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I was just thinking, just to throw out one science fiction thought.
Mm-hmm.
If, you know, the Matrix scenario in the movie The Matrix, where the machines take over, they put us to sleep, they use us as batteries, and we dream these pleasant dreams while they parasitize us. That's the least they can do, kind of,
to
keep us subdued.
Mm-hmm.
Seems to me like...
They invented Blocking Heads TV, as far as I'm able to determine.
I wish we had that much competence and foresight. But it seems to me that the realm of virtual worlds is actually a more plausible conduit to something like a Matrix-like world. In other words, it isn't that the machines rise up and say, okay, it's over for you guys. It's that we willingly slide into this world where more and more of our consciousness is absorbed in fantasy, and the price we pay, we have to keep the machines alive. We have to keep the planet running, certainly keep the computers alive, because they're what allow us to immerse ourselves in what will be ever more realistic worlds, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right down to the level of sensory gratification indistinguishable from actual sensory gratification, you know, eventually when you start, you know, planting electrodes and stuff. So it seems to me it's kind of like civil liberties. It's we will choose the slippery slope that leads to our demise, kind of.
Let me give you a slightly more optimistic scenario.
I didn't say this would happen. I said if right. You ask me what's the most plausible path to anything like the Matrix scenario, not a sudden rebellion by the machines, it's a much more gradual transition of our roles relative to them and our use of them. It's strictly speaking symbiotic, mutualistic, you know, we, I guess, would like it.
Well, think of virtual worlds as a new medium of communication and sociability. Just as telephones are, just as the Internet is many media, think about this particular medium as a medium of communication and sociability. you'll see that each of these media have different affordances and possibilities of what you can do with them. And some of them are more attractive than others, given what the other alternatives are. Virtual worlds are incredibly attractive medium for many people because they're immersive. And you can take really all of yourself and put it in there. And right now, even with relatively primitive technology, people can be completely absorbed in them. Imagine what happens as the technology becomes better. And we can do more in these worlds, and we can do them more easily, and more of they're more rewarding than they are before. You can easily see how people would want to transfer many of their social activities into these spaces, and they would essentially want to effectively live in these spaces, even though they also have lives in the so-called real world. And the boundary between the so-called real world and the virtual world will start to diminish, just as, for example, we no longer think of telephone space as a separate space in which people live. Certainly. We don't even think of cyberspace anymore as a separate space in which people live. That's the irony, you see, that in a matter of maybe 10 years, the term cyberspace has started to become quaint. I was at just at a meeting where people said, do you really use that term anymore? That's so quaint. Of course.
Wait, what's quaint about it? The idea that it's a separate place or what?
Yeah, that it's a separate place because, in fact, you spend a lot of your life online. I do, too. I don't regard it as going to a different place. I regard it as just like picking up the telephone.
I regard writing an email as different from encountering a clerk at the drugstore.
Certainly true. That's certainly true. But do you regard that when you pick up the phone and talk to someone, you're entering into something called telephone space? Is that how you view it? Or do you view it as it's just an adjunct of my everyday life?
Never thought about it. But, I mean, when the term virtual reality first showed up, I remember thinking, well, actually, this goes back to the movies. It actually goes back to the Greek theater. I mean, all these things, you know, kind of emerge in a more continuous fashion than we sometimes think, I guess. But, you know, it's funny. The term cyberspace, I think, comes from the William Gibson novel Neuromancer. Is that right?
That's right.
And then was popular. Then was applied to the Internet by John Perry Barlow.
I believe.
He's willing to take credit for it, I've noticed, anyway.
That's fine.
And it may be true.
But the idea of cyberspace presupposes that when you enter into these media, you are actually leaving an older world and entering into a new one. And the point I'm trying to make is that that's not exactly how people understand their relationship to this media anymore. They understand it to be as central and natural to their lives as television or telephones are.
Right.
Now, virtual spaces might get that same sense of naturalness. See, it looks bizarre to you now, right? Maybe to our grandchildren it wouldn't seem bizarre at all, just like the television or the telephone don't seem bizarre to us. And we've integrated them fully into our everyday lives. And why might that be? Because think about what you might use these spaces for. You and I, currently, are now using very primitive technologies to put on this blogger HDD.
Hey, that hurt. But go ahead.
I don't mean it in a bad way. Imagine that we had virtual spaces that we could construct in which we could do these talks. And they might be much more friendly for TV purposes, for watching purposes, because we could do more things in them, right?
Yeah.
Imagine that other members of the audience could enter these spaces and talk to us and have conversations with us. This would be a really exciting thing from the standpoint of the purposes behind this particular enterprise you're engaged in, Blogging Heads TV. And so it might well be that meeting people in space, conducting business with them, shopping, entertainment, all these things might be done through the use of virtual reality, and people wouldn't think anything of it. I mean, imagine, you know, someday there could be a law school in which the professor is represented in a virtual space, and the students are represented at desks in a virtual space, and you have lectures. Now, that's actually a pretty boring use of the space, I just want to point out. Because it's hardly exciting.
You said it, I didn't.
Yeah, but you could imagine forms of education in which, you know, people could do more things than just sit there and listen to an avatar speak at them.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, law school, I guess, takes us into the thing we've been promising to discuss.
You attack my reason for being.
Yeah, I would say the thing I was going to say about Neuromancer is the interesting thing about Neuromancer is when you read it, the cyberspace, I think that they're talking about, is a virtual world that is very absorbing, right? I mean, don't they directly plug their brains into something that takes them into, in effect, an imaginary world or something in Neuromancer, or am I wrong? I mean, it seems like, what I remember is when I read the novel, I thought, wait a second, they're applying cyberspace to the internet? This is totally different. It's just interesting that the internet...
It's interesting that you see it that way, because many early adopters of the internet understood themselves to be involved in an immersive medium from the get-go. They saw the internet as fundamentally addictive. I mean, it was the most exciting thing
in
the world.
Well, it was kind of I could see parts of that right away. It was more that, I don't know where exactly I was drawing the boundary line, but it does seem to me that the internet has become more like the cyberspace in Neuromancer. So in that sense, we should give John Perry Barlow credit for prescience for applying the term in a non-obvious way that maybe has become more valid.
In some sense, I would agree with you. And so that's one of the reasons why Beth and I did put together State of Play, is that we thought that the future of the internet was going to be in these immersive digital worlds. So we're not the first people to think this.
Mm-hmm.
But that in some sense, the internet realizes the early promise of what it was supposed to be about for some by moving to these graphically rich, immersive experiences. And that more and more of our internet experience may, in fact, be virtual in this form. Let me give you just one other example. Let's talk about protest and democracy. Online, using email, web spaces, some forms of protest aren't available because you can't get next to anybody on email or on websites. I call it the temptations problem. I can't get next to you, babe. You can't be next to someone in a website. In other words,
contagions of protests with email.
Certainly you can. You certainly can. It's a push medium. But what's interesting about virtual media is your avatar can actually be located next to another avatar. You can actually have the equivalent of virtual protest, and there have been such in virtual worlds where people get in large groups and they, storm the virtual Bastille. This is possible in a virtual, a graphical environment in a way that it's not possible in a web-based environment.
Well, what about five people instant messaging, and they get all riled up?
You can also have denial of service attacks too. I mean, let's not stop there, but the body. And the idea of proximity of bodies to each other is a central feature, although often unnoticed, about democratic politics.
Well, yeah, I mean, it gets into evolution. We are evolved to pay attention to all kinds of cues and be inspired or put off by all kinds of communicative cues that are, strictly speaking, superfluous to the communication.
I disagree with that last statement. I don't think they're superfluous at all.
Well, in the real world, they're not. But what I mean is... I can convey, when I respond to an inspiring speaker by virtue of how forceful or self-confident or whatever that person is, in a certain sense, those communicative cues don't speak to the merits of what the substantive message is that I'm responding to, the cause I'm signing on to.
You have a very impoverished notion of rhetoric. That's all I can say.
Well, no, I'm not saying it's not effective. I'm saying that
of its senses. I mean not simply in terms of effect, but also in what message is and how it's conveyed and what the medium is through which message is conveyed and what kind of inferences you make about the message and what you're doing when you communicate to someone. These things cannot simply be divided into a sort of disembodied code plus other stuff lapped on.
They
work together.
Here's my point. Of course they can't in the real world. That's why these virtual worlds have appeal, because they're more like the real world. Human psychology, as it has evolved, does not, in fact, separate these things. I understand
because
that.
We get an enormous amount of communication through gestures, through emotions, through signals. Yes, this
I
is
know,
the point.
But
right?
Here's my point. If somebody using gestures if somebody gets me whipped up and convinces me that we need a flat tax, and I sign a petition for a flat tax, and the reason I signed it is because that person is big and strong and I follow big, strong people, that the communication that convinced me is superfluous to the merits of the cause I signed on to. That's what I'm saying. That is a distinction.
That is to say, it's not a good reason to sign on to it.
That's
that the
how
person
I would put
who
it.
Gave you the piece of paper was big and strong. The only good reason for signing on to it is that the proposal is worthy.
Right, but in the real world, you're right that the virtual world is going to allow you to influence people maybe more readily, and yet for less legitimate reasons than might be the case if your communication were really strictly confined to substantive explicit messages.
I think, Bob, that you've touched on a very interesting point here. Let me suggest that it hasn't really changed. That think about con games on the internet. You know, I am the last surviving son of the foreign minister of Lower Slobobia.
Me too. That's quite a coincidence. But go ahead.
Yeah. Right. Absolutely. And those things are actually also drawing on features of our embodied existence, in terms of our notion of sympathy.
Sure.
And so in fact, those are communications that are trying to get us to do things. It's just that the form of rhetoric.
Yeah.
And you see, here we're on to a point of considerable importance. That's why I thought what the last thing you said was so interesting. The form of rhetoric adapts itself to the medium in which it can be expressed.
Right.
So that once you got the internet, people took a while for them to figure out, how do I scam people on the internet?
Right.
How do I engage in confiscate? Well, they figured it out. And now they're using features of our evolved existence, right, of the kind of primates we are,
right,
to basically scam using a new medium that nobody ever knew existed before.
No, I agree.
And just to follow up on the point that you were making, this will also happen in virtual spaces. That is, people will find new ways to use the weaknesses and strengths and redundancies and features of human evolution to communicate with people and have rhetorical effects on them using this new medium.
Yeah. No, I certainly agree that words alone, as printed, can also carry cues, communication, in a sense, strictly speaking, superfluous to the merits of the cause they purport to represent. But we should get on to this point where I indict your whole career, because we're running out of time.
Absolutely. I think it's time. I really think it's time. You've been altogether too nice to me, Bob.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah. And I resent it deeply.
Yeah, well, yeah, no, it's we're cruelest to the people we love the most. It's true. So anyway, you'll take this as a compliment. Let me move on to the cruel phase.
All right.
No, it's just a skepticism about legal discourse, and I guess one way to put it is, especially kind of constitutional arguments.
Yeah.
When I hear you sometimes hear lawyers or jurists arguing passionately about some principle, original intent, what the right reading of the Constitution is. And it just always reminds me of two people arguing about a piece of art as if one of them was actually right. And
mm-hmm.
and they think they are. And I just think that's crazy. No, see, you like this painting, you like that painting, can we go have lunch now? I mean, you can, you know, it's fine to argue about the merits, but to argue about them as if one of you were really, in some sense, right. And maybe you've heard this argument, but it seems to me that, first of all, well, there's a lot of constitutional argument that strikes me as being in this space mm-hmm. where there's just no telling, you know. I mean, of course, the notorious cases, a notorious case of what many people think is kind of overextension is, say, Roe versus Wade, where I gather that they looked at the Constitution and argued that they could infer that this right of, was it there that they argued that the right of privacy was actually embedded in the Constitution, even though not explicit, right?
Yeah, I understand. Yes,
but even if you get rid of the notorious overextensions, let's take something straightforward like the second.
I don't regard, by the way, Roe versus Wade as a notorious overextension.
Okay,
but we can talk about that later.
You know that it's criticized as by not just many conservatives, but by a number of liberals who think that it really properly is a legislative.
I have edited a book which I will plug here.
Go ahead.
Called What Roe versus Wade Should Have Said, in which 11 people rewrote the opinion in Roe versus Wade. Some agreeing with it, some disagreeing with it, and some in all different manners. So, yes, a very highly controversial case, no doubt.
Okay, let me give you, in a way, a more straightforward case, because here I'll argue that whatever position...
How about Brown versus Board of Education?
Well,
let me do
Second Amendment, because you're interested in that, okay?
Absolutely.
Right to bear arms.
Absolutely.
It's really pretty straightforward. In theory, it should be straightforward once you decide what they meant. Let's assume... I mean, I gather the big controversy is kind of, are they saying any given person should be able to keep their arms like in their house? Or are they saying the state should be able to organize a militia, but if the state, you know, the individual states constituting the union, or what, right? Let's suppose we found a document that made it totally clear.
Mm-hmm.
What they meant was every individual person should have the right to bear arms. Now, that would be about as good as it gets in terms of constitutional interpretation, right? It would seem simple after that. And yet, it's actually not, because then the question arises, right to bear what arms? What they were on the one hand, what they were talking about explicitly was a single fire musket that it takes you 5 seconds to reload.
Yeah.
And that, of course, would not be a great peril to our security. If everyone had one of those, that would pretty much rule out spree killings, you know. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, what they were also saying was everyone should have a right to own a kind of state-of-the-art, cutting-edge weapon of the kind that an individual can operate. So wait a second. Now that would be like Stinger anti-aircraft missiles, bazookas, and it seems to me...
suitcase bombs.
Yeah. Now, you can argue it either way. You can say, no, they meant single-fire, non-automatic, you know, even a rifle that can only hold one cartridge. You can argue that. That was their intent in one sense. In another sense, their intent was to be as formidable as an oppressive government would be.
Right.
Cruise missiles with nuclear warhead. It just seems to me... who knows? You can argue that either way. What is? It's just not calculus. It's not a mathematical theorem, and that's my feeling.
Yeah. Well, first of all, as to the last thing you said, I fully agree with you. Law isn't calculus, and it's not a mathematical theorem. There are some people, by the way, Ronald Dworkin being the most famous, very famous legal philosopher, who argued that we must work on the assumption that there are right answers to hard questions of law. This is not my view. But in fact, it is a well-known position in jurisprudence. I take a somewhat more pragmatic.
That's the kind of mathematical theorem view of this, almost.
Not quite. I don't think that would be Dworkin's view of what he was doing. Let's back up for a second and ask a slightly different question. And the question is, what is the function of law in a society like the one in which we live? And that might help us understand what the nature of legal argument is supposed to be about. As you think about it, what do you think the function of law is? Then we can decide whether we're doing it poorly or well. What would it be for you?
The function of law is to regulate interactions among people such that they can realize benefits. I've never even been asked. I have no idea. Such that they can realize benefits that interaction is conducive to, for one thing. I'm not going to say it's to realize natural law, as some people kind of would tend to say.
Not what I'm doing. I've asked you because I knew that you would have a rather sophisticated view about it, having read your work. I mean, you would probably focus on the fact that we need institutions, and the institutions have to run fairly efficiently. People have to be able to realize their life plans and goals. We have to restrain arbitrary power. We have to essentially allow society to run, right? I mean, this is related to that stuff that you write about in Non-Zero and other books.
Thank you.
And part of the idea is that, of course, this will change over time. New institutions will come into being. Old ones will pass away. The structure of society will change. The forms of ends that human beings take on will vary in different cultures, although some of them will be very basic. But the idea is to create a framework in which human action can occur and to restrain the excesses of power and arbitrariness. And that's what the most we can hope for with law. That is to say, we can't expect law will produce perfect justice, because it never does. It often is very unjust. But that's what it does. It's a kind of framework for human action. So if we think about law in these functional, pragmatic terms, that's not the only way to think about law, I just want to point out. Certainly a lot of people would be very upset that I was talking in these terms. Then we might ask, well, what's well done or badly done legal argument? And well done or badly done legal argument would be legal argument that helps us perform these tasks. Right? Is it argument that can lead people to have some expectation about how institutions are supposed to run and what kinds of obligations and duties people have and can restrain arbitrary power and can essentially allow people to pursue their lives in some degree of dignity? That's what the goal is. Legal argument succeeds or fails to the extent that it can allow you to do that. It doesn't have to be mathematics for it to do that. It merely has to be able to make more or less persuasive arguments. In other words, it's in the realm of the plausible as opposed to the demonstrable. Now, you know your Aristotle, I'm sure, and you know
wrong,
the Aristotle.
But go ahead.
You're an old Aristotle fan, and you know that Aristotle makes the distinction between the realm of the certain, of which he gives mathematics as the example, and the realm of the plausible or the possible, in which he gives dialectic and rhetoric as being the examples of the arts of the plausible and the possible. Law is clearly in the latter camp. It's about persuading people about what's reasonable and what's not reasonable, and what is a plausible way to follow existing rules and what's not a plausible way, with the hope that people can find their way through life without getting in too much trouble, and also that tyrants and people who engage in egregious acts of power can be restrained. That's what the goal is.
Well, that's a fairly modest conception of your role in life, and I applaud you for the modesty.
Thank you for my modesty. Yeah.
And I should say, I mean, my conception of what valid legal argument is no less exalted than my conception of what I do, every day. I mean, when I make an argument about politics or policy, I mean, it wasn't like before the Iraq War. It wasn't that I was 100% sure that the war was a bad idea, even though I argued as if that was the case, because mm-hmm. that's kind of those are kind of the rules of rhetoric. You act like you know what you're talking about. It was just that I thought probably it was a bad idea. And in any event, there tend to be an overwhelming failure to acknowledge the evidence on the side of the argument that it was a bad idea. There was a weird disproportion in the way we're focusing on it. So that's maybe consistent with what your conception of valid of what worthwhile legal rhetoric is. It's helpful in this process by which we argue things through and hope we don't screw up too badly. But it also
provides a framework for institutions, because most politics has to be conducted through institutions.
Right, but I'm not imagining it right when I think that there are people who, and I'll give you an example. You probably know Jeff Rosen, right? Very noted. I was at the New Republic when he was, and as I recall at the editorial meetings, maybe it was just the passion he brought to the argument, but I had the sense that, and you would know legal schools of thought better than I do and which one he belongs to, I had the sense he really thought there's like some kind of natural law out there, some sort of platonic thing. And he thought his side of the argument was in tune with that, and the people he was opposed to, their argument was not. Do you think I'm misreading his sheer passion for argumentation, or is he?
I don't know if I would say that Jeff's a believer in natural law, but I have seen before and I've practiced before the idea that you know your argument is right, and you try to persuade everyone in the room that that's the right call.
Sure.
Even when, in fact, people can make plausible arguments on the other side.
Well, this gets back to what we were saying about how the communication has to be geared to the way the human mind works, and
right.
people are receptive to the claim that you are right and the other person is wrong, and so it helps to argue that way.
Well, I'll give you an example to go back full circle to the beginning of this conversation. I have long believed that what I know about the Bush administration's domestic surveillance policies from 2000 on to the Protect America Act, that though they were illegal, it's my view is they're illegal. They violate separation of powers, and they violate FISA. I know very intelligent lawyers who disagree with me on this question. I have read their arguments. I am not persuaded by them. They are persuaded by them, but I am not persuaded by them. I am still convinced, after having seen all the arguments, that I am right about the legality of these programs. Is it possible to have a world in which people disagree about important questions of law and both are convinced they're right? And is it possible that the system can still function? I think it can. I mean, I not only believe in it, I've seen it done, as they say about baptism. That is, in fact, the world of legal argument.
Yeah. Okay. That does bring us back and probably is a good place to end.
We'll wait for another conversation for you to impugn other aspects of my professional life, which I'm really looking forward to.
Well, also, in this age of transparency, I can get a lot of data about your personal life. And,
absolutely.
And we can go that route.
I'm sure. I hope this will be the beginning of a number of conversations, because we still have many more things to talk about. We didn't even get to all the things that were on our list.
No, and in fact, the last thing we were talking about is related to the question of kind of legal realism, kind of what is happening when the Supreme Court makes a decision.
I would love to talk to you about that. I'd like to talk to you about things about constitutional interpretation, and maybe we can get to talk about cultural evolution a little bit, something both you and I are interested in.
Everything we discuss is part of cultural evolution when we're not talking about the natural selection of genes, pretty much. So
There we go.
Well, this was great, Jack.
It was a pleasure talking to you, and I hope we do it again soon.
Okay, me too. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.